I would just say there's one misperception of our veterans, and that is they are somehow damaged goods. Although if we tell our veterans enough that this is what's wrong with them, then they actually start believing it.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Dead Reckoning Radio. On this episode, we have the three authors of Lucky Joe, Leo Jenkins, Brian Kimber, and David Rose. We made a post on Instagram giving you guys the chance to do a Q&A with the authors. We went question by question, but in general, we talked about the idea behind the book, what the book is actually about, and how these three authors work together in order to give you guys a finished piece. We hope y'all enjoy.
What's up, guys? How y'all doing?
Good.
Good.
Yeah, so right now we got the authors of Lucky Joe. That's Leo Jenkins, David Rose, and Brian Kimber here, better known as BK. Let's kind of just go around the room and do a quick introduction slash background on y'all before we get into this Q&A. Leo?
I'm Leo Jenkins, one of the writers of Lucky Joe and other various works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Further back than that, a lot of that work has been influenced or inspired by my time as a medic in 3rd Ranger Battalion.
I'm David Rose, and I'm the author of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I am David Rose, but I'm the author of a couple military nonfiction pieces, and more recently, a couple dark fantasy works. And prior to the arts, I had served in the Marine Corps for just about 5 years, and I guess it's important to say during that time I had read a ton of not so much military fiction, but high fantasy works, which we wanted to use this as an opportunity to take a military theme and put some inject like a really good dose of fiction into a theme where you don't really see a lot of the fiction elements. So,
yep, BK here, Brian Kimber, and I was in the United States Air Force pararescue teams for a while, and then I was a longtime overseas contractor after that, and now I host a weekly international news podcast and still do a little bit of writing, mostly nonfiction. This is really my first crack ever at writing fiction, so I was really happy to try it, and it was really cool you guys asked, so thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, right, since you already mentioned, let's dive in kind of that. Is David here sought you out and was like, hey, you want to write a fictional book?
Yeah. So I actually, it was funny. So David reached out. I've known David, you know, through social media, mutual friends of ours for years, and he just reached out and he's like, hey, we have this idea for this book, and the only parameter he gave me was like, it's a guy named Joe, he's in Afghanistan, and he has some sort of interaction with the pararescue team. And he's like, other than that, you can do what you want. You can make him the guy a villain, you can make him a hero, you can make him a jerk, you can make him whatever, and you do run with it. And I was like, I've never really tried to do anything like this before, but I was like, why not? What the hell? And actually, I did lie to David. I'm just going to say it on a podcast because he asked me several times how things were going. And I said, oh, yeah, it's coming along. And I hadn't written a word until like literally the day before you wanted it due. And I was like, okay, I said I was going to do it. So I sat down in one day and I just banged out like the whole thing. And I just sent it off to him. I didn't really even think much. And he's like, yeah, it looks good. And I was like, okay, great. And then, that's how it kind of happened.
Have you always like worked better under that pressure?
Kind of, yeah. Like whether it was in school or anything else, whenever I had a paper due or anything, it was like always last minute. And in some ways, I feel like if I had more time, I would have been constantly editing it. So it's almost maybe better to have a deadline sometimes. Like, you know, you just do it and you send it off and let the chips fall where they may. Otherwise, I feel like with myself, I'd always be wanting to go back to it and be like, no, I got to add more. And maybe sometimes it's better to have that deadline.
Yeah. So David, what made you seek out BK specifically?
Well, as he had mentioned a moment ago, I'd known of BK's writing for, we're looking at maybe 7 years now. A guy he had contracted with was a guy I was in recon with who, I don't know, maybe 2014, he'd sent me an article saying, man, you got to read this. And since then, I'd paid attention to Brian's work, and I knew that he was, you know, more of like what you might call an essayist. And but you know passion, you know conviction when you see it. And Leo and I knew from the beginning, like, hey, we were going to work on this together, but we were like, we want to get a third writer. And we knew that that wasn't necessarily going to be an easy thing, because you have to find someone who's willing, someone who, you know, who's capable. You have to have all the ingredients. And we also wanted to have a little bit of a diversity in the background of the people themselves. And the fact that Brian was a PJ, I was like, okay, this is something that we can really work with. It's cool because I had kind of envisioned prior, because I really gave him sparse notes as far as, hey man, you know, guiding notes. And the fact that he ended up doing this scene, which is mostly takes place in the air, was perfect. And so, yeah, I guess I kind of just predicted with some success as far as what it might look like, and it worked out.
Yeah, it reads really well, and that's what was cool is each portion of the book is an author's specific portion, but we're not ever told whose portion's whose, and I think people will eventually kind of start figuring it out as they read other works that you guys have put out there. But what's cool about BK's piece is, like, it's almost all conversational, and it's actually where you really get to meet the character of Joe Watts and how much it linked up with yours and Leo's stories as well, with that sparse notes, like you said. So that is pretty interesting how that worked out so well.
Yeah, and you know, there was a this reminds me a bit of what it looks like when you have an editor oversee an anthology. You know, for those that don't know, a collection is and an anthology are essentially the same. It's just an anthology is a collection of multiple authors, and generally there's an editor who usually sticks their own work in there. But then, you know, somebody kind of edits it all for continuity purposes and stuff. And so there was some of that at the end, but there was no heavy lifting at all.
So with you saying that you already knew that Leo was going to be a part of this, is this something that y'all have talked about, like, multiple times? Like, hey, we need to write a book together? Or was it just like, hey, this is the book, we're going to do it, let's make it happen now?
Leo, how many wild ideas do we talk about on any given phone call?
Oh, yeah, anytime we're on, the times we get on a phone call in an hour, we probably hash out three or four different books, you know, like, oh, we could do this and we could do this. And, like, we spent, a little bit more about David and I, like, we spent a little over a week together in essentially an oversized van in an RV in the Verses and Curses tour a couple of years ago, where, you know, we drove up and down the East Coast of the United States, slinging spoken word and, you know, in various places, classy establishments to, the longest running strip club in Atlanta. And in the course of that experience, you know, we found out pretty quickly, I mean, before the trip even really started, like, we liked working together. There's a thing there where kind of we both kind of have a different approach to things, but we both get excited about the kind of the same type of project and the same type of thing. And we talked quite a bit about different things and writing and everything along that trip. And then there was kind of a vacuum where, you know, it wasn't. And I think he kind of called me. Oh, it felt like almost out of the blue, and like, hey, I got this idea, and I'm like, I'm in. You know, and it was like very little. It's like, you know, it's going to be kind of this thing. But, like, I was like, yeah, I'm in. Let's do it. You know, so it was a quick yes without much explanation for me. And then I think, like, my part in it, I was doing something else, and I kind of put that aside, writing project wise. And I think it was War and Peace. I'd got that up to a certain point, and set that down, and then hopped into Lucky Joe for a week or so. And but yeah, it was. It was something that we knew that we were going to work on something together. It was just a matter of what it was and when. And I think, you know, that this is probably the first of, you know, there'll probably be other things in the future because it seems to work.
So with that, did he give you much notes as well, or just a very general theme?
Yeah, it was similar. It wasn't a lot of, you know.
I'd say the one difference being is that we were at the time really putting in the base construction of the project. So there was a lot of back and forth. I know that we were, like, sending each other links about because we'll get into that question in a minute, I suppose, but, you know, the 10th Mountain Division, which is a unit none of us were in. So we're like, okay, we want to have, you know, as much accuracy as we can about, like, you know, hey, were they using, you know, M4s or you know, A2s, or you know, were they using this type of Humvee, or, you know, or were they even in the battle space at this time? So there was a lot of that, and on the technical side.
So we posed some questions on Instagram earlier to ask you guys direct questions, and the first one that came up was, how did you co-write the story? Was there an initial collaboration meeting followed by regular check-ins? We've kind of already touched on that, but
I think we just all kind of were working on our segments at our own pace, and then there is there's some, like, essentially what you might call the beginning and the end. I wanted to get I got the beginning written so Leo could take a look at it, and then from there kind of use that as sort of a diving board, because I can't remember, maybe Leo, you can remember, like, how we agreed what the order would be, but at some point we're like, okay, we know what we want the first inner story to be, so it's very important to get the prologue finished. And but once we got to that point, it was just kind of, it was pretty loose. It was like, hey, you know, maybe just check in here and there, but
I think when I was able to start work on it, finished maybe 4 or 5 days to write the part, and then gave it to you, and you're like, ah, cool, but I'm not going to look at it for a while because I'm working on this other thing. And that's always like the, you know, like for the writer, you're like, but I need my immediate gratification and my feedback, you know, like I need somebody to tell me this is good or not, you know, like sort of thing. And it was, you know, a couple months of, and then, you know, you got, you know, back in, you know, back into the swing of this project and hopped in like, oh man, this is, you know, this is like, it was like devilishly good or something. It's like, this works. And I was, cause you don't know, you know, exactly. We didn't know exactly how this thing was going to work out. If it was going to work out, we just knew it was going to be a fun thing. So, you know, putting this piece up there, like, is this what you want, Dave? You know, like, is this what you're thinking of? You know, I don't know. Then your part came. And then when I was able to read your part, I'm like, okay, it does. Okay. This does click in. And then with BK's part coming in the middle, I'm like, that is the connecting piece. And it just all kind of clicked in really well.
And Brian's was the last to come in. And right before that, Leo and I had a pretty fun experience of essentially editing each other's work, which is a conversation unto itself, because that is not an easy thing to do. Not that it's hard to edit someone's work per se, but to develop a sort of working relationship to kind of understand, like, the way a person writes, the logic behind some of their decisions. So you don't want to fine tune it towards your own direction. But it was really fun when because we've read each other's prior published works. We've performed live with one another with the Verses and Curses tour, and so there ends up becoming this pretty cool relationship to where there was one spot in my story that he had very, very specific notes about, hey man, let's you know, here's a way to improve this one crucial point, and it was absolutely dead on. And so that was a really fun feeling. It might sound a little cheesy, but it really kind of mimics that sort of small unit cohesion in the military that we illustrate in the book.
No, absolutely. And that kind of leads perfectly right into this next question, because I know personally, but I kind of want to hear y'all talk about that a little bit more, about editing each other's works with these kind of differences, is with the potential different styles, opinions, and experiences, how did you approach the subject? And then were there really any disagreements as far as direction of the story? Because he gave you these specific notes within your portion, and then you've also given him specific notes within his portion. Like, how did those... was it like any hurt feelings or anything, or like was it all like, hey, this just needs to kind of, like, you guys all understood it all?
Well, I'll put it this way. There was one area that we were both really committed. There was this one area in Leo's work where we both had different ideas that we were both rather convinced was the way to go. And I knew Leo and I were going to have a talk, I was so damn nervous about making sure that I convey my message accurately, but do so in a way that doesn't piss someone off. That I actually consulted a recon buddy of mine who's like this big, you know, Wall Street guy. And I'm like, what do you do in these moments? You know, I was like, and he's like, yeah, don't worry about it. You know, like maybe get a third party or you know, and I was like, third party for that. You know, I was like, we're not talking about, you know, a $1 billion deal here. And, but this what I'm saying is that is how serious I personally took two things, which is the artistic integrity and maintaining the friendship and the relationship, and it was really cool to be able to discuss something of that level, to where, like, you know, just bouncing back and forth, and eventually, you know, you're like, okay, there ends up becoming this finalized working model, and you know, and ends up being a collaborative effort, and it's cool because I mean, at the end of the day, it's writing on a page, and this is something that two grown men are really burning some gray matter. Like, no, and the mutual goal is what is the best for the book, yeah. You know, and that's a really cool feeling.
And the question of different voices in it. Like, I think that's what makes this book really unique an interesting read, because there are three unique writing styles, but it's done in such a way that it doesn't distract from you know, the continuity of the tale. It actually really helps improve it. And so there are parts, you know, what David's talking about is, you know, like where I have this is my writing style, and there are elements to my writing style that are not. Would not be considered like the most technically sound way to get this story out or to tell this. And I understand that, and I recognize this is where a lot of the conversations were with a particular part in what I had written. And we tried it both ways, and we really truly collaborated. And that's another thing for me personally, where this was such an exciting thing to do. For as far as a project, because we were truly collaborating on it. We had our parts that we were writing, but it's not often in this career field, in this profession, where you get to actually work not only with another person on a book, like with other writers, but somebody who you respect, someone who you have a pretty parallel arc with. You know, if you look at David's, you know, like the work that he's done, you know, with No Joy. And then like my book with Lest We Forget, like the storylines are like, it's really kind of interesting. A lot of the places that we've been around the same times and the experiences that we had. And so to be able to really collaborate on this, it was a unique experience for somebody who is like locked in a closet with, you know, a laptop by themselves most of the time, to actually get this feedback. And it's editorial in a sense, and you know, you're used to working with editors, but here's another writer who, you know, and that there's multiple minds attempting to accomplish this one overall task, and they all have different ways of going about it, and it worked. It ended up, you know, there's compromises here or there, but like it ended up being, I think it really, what we have is something really unique in its creative sense, and in the voice of this book is, it's special, I think, as a result of that effort that was put forth. There was no, it's good enough, we'll put it out. Like, there was that gray matter that was burnt on it, and a lot of care went into that final product.
I wanted to ask Brian, actually, is because of all your experience with op-eds, is it like, did it feel similar?
Not at all. Like, yeah, the only time I'd written plenty of like essays, Before I started the podcast, I kind of started the podcast because I had started writing, you know, for a military news website, and I was like doing news and opinion columns and stuff like that. So like I was used to writing that, and so this was completely different. Like just even like sitting down and like thinking of like a dude's name, you know, a character's name, and you're just like, wow, I could really name this guy anything I want. This is trip, you know. It's weird, you know. And like I've been telling people, because I didn't know what I was doing, I really based 100% of it on like experiences that I and my friends have had and conversations that I and my friends have had. Because they say, you know, like just write what you kind of know in life, and so that's what I did. And so yeah, it was a lot different though.
So with that, creating these fictional characters and stepping into this fictional world, this is obviously your first time doing it. What what was like the funnest part and like the most difficult part within that?
It's probably just getting started. It was like, as I was trying to think, like I knew what David wanted was at the end of the book, like I had to establish a relationship between like this character Joe and like this and this pararescueman, and like I was like, how am I going to do that? And so I had to like figure out how I was going to do that. And I thought to myself, well, a real world, and as has happened to friends of mine, a real world and a way to tie it in would be like as if this PJ had worked on like say a Green Beret team, that, you know, this guy, they had mutual friends, and that's like a very realistic scenario. So that's kind of how I like tied it all in, and that way this Joe character has some empathy with this PJ because they have mutual friends, and that's kind of how I, and so they feel free to start talking with, you know, talking about intimate stuff, which is what they did.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And within the op-ed pieces that you put in, you're working with like a professional editor.
Yeah, well, technically, but they never really censored me when I was doing op-eds. So I never really had any heavy editing. I just wrote it and sent it in, and they gave me my, you know, $100 a week or whatever I was making. Like, I was making, like, next to nothing. But it was still, I mean, if you're getting paid to write on the internet, that alone is, like, a huge accomplishment, even if it's, like, peanuts, because, you know, it's difficult. You know, it's tough. I tell people all the time, it is so hard to make money in an internet-based business, whether it's, you know, a news website, any of that. It's difficult. So, yeah, it's a grind.
With that, when you finally sent your stuff to David, what kind of feedback did you get?
So I sent it off. So I write it all in like the one day, basically. And I sent it off to David. I'm not really thinking much of it. And I'm like, this kind of sucks or whatever. But I'm like, I'll send it to David, see what he thinks. And he writes back. He's like, dude, it's solid. And I'm like, okay. And I told him, I'm like, listen, I'm not like, I'm new at this, so feel free to, like, you know, add in, you know, any kind of metaphors or descriptive phrases that you think are accurate. And it'll be interesting because I have yet to read the whole thing through. So I still have yet to read the book, so I'm excited to read it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's perfect then. Well, I'll say, as the first reader of it all, I can kind of tell, like, earlier, like you were saying, as a writer, you, like, finally pass it off. And when you gave it to me whenever you were here for War and Pieces, I can just tell you, like, are you going to read it? You going to read it? And then David starts messaging me, hey, have you read it yet? Have you read it yet? And I'm like, I promise I will. And I sat down and read it all in one sitting and edited it too, my own way. And I was like, yeah, this is something special because there's three unique perspectives, three unique voices that coincided really, really well to kind of just, we were talking to Luke Ryan before, like, if it didn't have three names on the front, you would think it was just written by one person. So you guys did very, very well. We already kind of talked about it a little bit, but are these characters based actually on real people? You're making it sound like it's almost based off of your life and your experience.
For me, yeah. So it was based definitely on me. The characters were totally based on it. My PJ characters was definitely based on two different friends I know who had two very similar experiences, and so yeah, it was based a lot on that because that was the easiest way for me to approach it. So that's what I did.
Yeah, so I went a slightly different route. I didn't do, you know, my character, you could say, is not really based on me. It's not the same branch I was in or anything. But I definitely fused some of the characters I'd met through the military and through contracting that I had seen this reoccurring personality, which is the very religious American service member. And I remember I had a team leader in Afghanistan who was this sort of like kind of this like modern day Abraham Lincoln. He was like extraordinarily tall, and he was like even tempered and funny, and he would go from like childish to like when he needed to be serious. You could see the guy was brilliant, and you know, he's just very devoted to his wife. And I mean, this is the contracting days. This is where people are like, you know, so what kind of penicillin did you use when you came back from Phuket, you know?
And savages.
Here, yeah. And then here's this guy who stood out, to say the very least. And he was one of several. And so I wanted to kind of fuse some of these reoccurring personalities into a character who would have a relationship with Joe Watts that would probably be different than all the people who loved him. So, that was really my initial motivation, was to create a character that would, at the end of the day, be able to shed a light on Joe Watts that shows how three-dimensional Joe Watts is, and how, even more so, how three-dimensional these inner team relationships ultimately are.
The character, or at least my primary character, is probably a bit of a Frankenstein, a Frankenstein's monster, I should say, right? Yeah. They're kind of, some of it is like things that have happened with people who I know, and other things are moments that, in my own personal experience, is the thought of what's the worst case scenario if that would have happened, you know, like playing that out as a medic, right? Like, or the imagination, you know, that takes place of like, this is the event, but what could have happened in that event? And to let it go from that like real world thing of like, you know, search and rescue mission in Afghanistan, it went this way. But what could have happened if it would have gone a different way? And it very well could have at this moment, that moment. And it was a fun experience, because I'm new to fiction as well, is to be able to take the way I would have written, or the way I have written, and with like Lest We Forget, and like this is what happened, and I have to kind of stick to what happened. It's a true story. So, but to be able to, this is what was happening, and then I want to diverge from that, and I want to just take this moment and make this other thing happen there, and then just follow the consequences of that, and allow that those consequences to then, and then just kind of chase it. And again, this was one of my first exercises in fiction as well, that was just the kind of methodology that I followed with it, you know. And then to take and, okay, other people who I know who had these experiences, and what could have happened to them, you know, in that, and to try to hybrid a little bit of the actual experience, and then being as creative and as imaginative with it as the, say, confines of the story will allow, but to still make it feel as very real, and things that like do happen in the military and in combat. So
I think it's interesting that you guys are moving more towards fiction, and I think that this is only the beginning for probably, well, David, you've already obviously written some fiction, but we were talking about before about how nonfiction writing, typically you're kind of confined to the truth, and like, how do you make the truth that much more interesting if it's not as interesting? And so within this fictional world, you're able to have a lot more fun, I think, and it forces you to be creative, and it forces you to put yourself in these positions that could have happened, that like you have thought about in those moments, right? Man, if it just went this way, this is exactly how it would have gone down, and you imagine it in that moment. And so now to kind of reflect on that in this space, I'm sure this is what the product of it, of that is. Well, kind of speaking right into that is, do you think it is healthy to continually focus on the war? Is there a point where we must move on?
I'm not entirely certain that it's a linear thing. We discussed this last night. War is a character building thing, and it is something that happens at a particular chapter in our life. You know, where typically speaking, it is when you know, like people are having their college experience, right? And you know, in their early 20s, for the most part, and that there are characteristics that become your character in those events. And I think that it would be disingenuous, and it would be detrimental to you to completely and utterly to leave that behind. There's a lot of good things that come from that you understand what you're capable of. You know, you really realize how far out your limits are, and a lot of things in the mental and emotional strength, and how much you can carry, and what you're capable of. And I think to completely throw that baby out with the bathwater is not a good idea. I think that to be genuine to our character arc throughout our entire story of our life is to take the elements that were developed in that chapter, the war chapter, and to carry the best of them. And the ones that are not serving, peel those things away and drop them, you know. But allow that character, your character to carry that through the deeper chapters of the book that you're writing, that is your life.
Yeah, I want to jump in on that because I've noticed that, like, it's when the farther away from, you know, my military career you get, it just feels like, it feels like you were just a completely different person back then. I mean, it's been a while since I was in the military now, you know, but, and I don't know, it's like, it's somewhat like being like the old high school quarterback hero, you know. Nobody wants to sit around, you know, listen to the fucking 60-year-old guy talk about the glory days. And so, like, I feel like I'm glad I was in the military and had that experience, but, like, I don't want that to be, like, my whole life or, like, who defines me. You know, I want to be known for other things rather than just doing that. And, you know, especially in this day and age of social media, you know, you guys all know when you throw up the cool guy picture of you in Afghanistan with all the kit on, you know, that gets all the traction, right? But then when you throw up, like, hey, I wrote a book, that gets like 1/10 of the traction, right? So
I have an experience.
Sure. But yeah, you know, but it's hard. But you want to, like, move on and be like, you know, this, there's more to me, you know, than just that. And I don't want to be like, for me personally, I don't want to be like, and plus I feel my, compared to like other guys of my contemporaries, you know, I mean, I didn't do shit compared to, like, you know, I have some war hero friends out there that, you know, you never would even know. But I don't want to, like, you know, constantly, like, you know, be like, oh, I was this in the military. It's like, yeah, you know, that was a while ago. I'm going to move on. I'm going to take those lessons, like Leo was saying, you know, take those lessons that you learned. But, you know, that's not your whole persona anymore. You know, you got to kind of come up with something else.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said when answering that question. Can you actually repeat the question?
Do you think it's healthy to continually focus on the war? Is there a point where one must move on?
Yeah. Yeah. And as Leo said, we had touched on this last night. So look at the evolution of some of Leo's books. The first one was about time in the military and war. The second one had more to do with transitioning. And the third was about traveling. So right there, you see a distinct evolution. And so in Leo's case, he's just circling back to the war theme. The last two books I've had published have absolutely fuck all to do with not only just fuck all to do with the war in Iraq or Afghanistan, but fuck all to do with this world. I've written a secondary world dark fantasy, and have, you know, high aspirations to continue to do so. But this is an opportunity to circle back to a theme that is not just, you know, defining in our own past, but extraordinarily interesting and extraordinarily entertaining. Look at every video game, you know. I think to the guy who asked that question, this is just something we wanted to do. You know, it doesn't mean that the next 40 books would be a regurgitation of, you know, a couple deployments.
One thing that always, like when my first kind of got put onto you and I started ordering your books, it was obviously initially from Sand and Time, actually, because we're heavy into poetry, and then I read No Joy, and then I see you finally put out the dark fantasy, the Necromancer's Will, and I read your bio and it literally doesn't say anything about you being a veteran or served as a Marine or anything. It literally, you didn't even mention it, and I was like, all right, this guy knows, like, he gets it, he's moving on, like, he's a writer who served in the military.
Yeah, and it's, I would say, you know, I'm not like a former recon Marine that likes to write. I'm a writer that used to be in the Marines.
Yeah.
You know, but swinging back to the theme of war is something that, you know, like, there are people who are extraordinarily successful writers that pay military advisors to be like, hey, is there a safety on a Glock 21? You know, we know if there's a safety or not on a Glock 21. We have such a deep well of experience and you might say in certain ways expertise that I think it'd be unhealthy not to dive into this occasionally.
Yeah, know? Write what you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you know that thing, write it. You have that experience, use it. If you want to write, use that.
Well, it's like you're saying, it was part of your life, and it was such a fun part of your life, and it brought you so much joy, and it brought you so much pain. And so to circle back on it, I absolutely agree. It is healthy, but in like those small doses, and then you move on and do your other stuff. But as far as, like you're talking about earlier, about posting the pictures just within the social media world, it's like, being a veteran in some sense, it is extremely marketable. Like if you're thinking about making money on the internet, like unfortunately you do have to kind of leverage it. And
you do.
Yeah, you feel like you're losing part of yourself in it because you're like, I'm playing this card, but it's like that's what the people want.
Right. And you know what? I the way I look at it is like I get so like when I people like check out when people like look at my podcast, they might take a second look because they say like, "Oh, I see he was a veteran of the PJ teams," you know, but that's all it gives you is like maybe a little bit of a foot in the door and people give you a little modicum of respect and give you that chance. But after that, it's on you and you have to move forward with that and prove what you got right now, you know, because nobody cares. If you suck, you suck, you know, you got to like keep proving yourself every day.
You and I talked about it, David, with some of your actual like writer friends who aren't in the military world at all. You're like, they thought that you were crazy that you haven't leveraged this a little bit more.
Yeah. You want me to go into that a little?
Yeah, absolutely.
A couple of years ago, I was at the Horror Writers Association's annual meetup. It's called StokerCon. And I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And it's a real big just meet and greet type thing. All sorts of panels. It was a really good time. And it was funny because we did it in this big hotel. And this is like, you can't get more Midwest than this. And in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and they were hosting all these weddings and everything. And you have to just take a guess what people who come to StokerCon look like. It was like, you know, like Hogwarts. You know, like everybody looked like Severus Snape, you know, like getting into the elevator with people who are like, you know, going for the bridal party. It was really hilarious. But during those 2-3 days, you know, like pitching projects to agents and editors and things like that, is that you know, they'd ask a little bit about your writing background. And I was like, well, you know, I'm kind of jumping to the other side of the library here. I was like, I started out in military nonfiction, and that would almost stop them immediately. And like, and so you're into dark fantasy now, because I don't really particularly enjoy horror per se, but there's a it's very debatable actually, as far as like where does dark fantasy begin and horror end, and it's a good place to go because the writers that are entrenched in horror, they are very dedicated. They're always talking about, you know, craftsmanship and it's good for, you know, sharpening your tools. But they're like, okay, so you want to write dark fantasy, or you may say horror fantasy, and they're like, why on earth haven't you leveraged the fact that you're a vet? You know, like you could do military horror, like Dog Soldiers and stuff like that. And I kept hearing it, and not just at that convention, but just, you know, throughout the past few years. And I don't know. I really don't remember what I answered, but in my head, at least, I was thinking, because I don't want to do what so many people do now in the entertainment industry, particularly the book business, which is leverage their identity politics. You know, I'm of the belief that it's what matters is what the person wrote, far more than who wrote it. And I know that not everybody feels that way, but that's how I feel. But you're absolutely right. There comes a point in time where you do have to acknowledge your own assets that as Brian said, can at least get your foot in the door. But also, like he said, is that once your foot's in the door, it's up for your work to speak for itself. So
we also talked about it before, and we talked about it in my lit review class. About reading bios, like an author's bio, before or after you read the piece. And we had this huge debate about it. And I found out that most people, at least that are reviewing stuff, want to try to read the bio after if they can. So then the work stands alone. And then like the author kind of is like the cherry on top, like, oh, okay, they actually have some accolades. Oh, they actually kind of know what they're talking about. But a lot of people agree that once they know who the author is, they know their background, they know their story, that automatically is going to influence their opinion on the work. And I find that pretty interesting, because that's kind of exactly this case, is you guys are seeing subject matter experts on this, so people are automatically going to see this book and be like, okay, at least I know that they're going to know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's smart.
Which is one reason, I suppose, to answer one of the questions is why we opted for a unit none of us were in. It's because it was
a bit of
an artistic challenge, for one.
So the question is, with each of you having a special operations background, how/why did you decide to center the book on 11 Bravos and 10th Mountain? Was this random, or did it serve a purpose?
So, for a bit of an artistic challenge, for one. And two is that Joe Watts is meant to be a bit of a sort of archetypical you know, the golden son of the GWAT, you know, the wild child, the people who I saw. I was recalled in 2008, and I had to go up to Kansas City, Missouri, and it was like 400 Marine grunts, and they all had goatees and earrings and everything. And let me tell you, they weren't talking about mom got an apple butter. They were talking about, oh, I haven't seen you since you stole the Domino delivery guy's truck and crashed it in, you know, somewhere out in 29 Palms. Those were the conversations that were happening. And those guys had done 2, 3, 4 deployments apiece and were the people who get praised, you know, on the nightly news for years and years and years. And they were highly lethal, but they were not Boy Scouts. Joe Watts, we're like, well, how can you sort of generalize the GWAT? So I wouldn't say, hey, let's have him be a Navy SEAL. Let's have him be a PJ. Let's have him, you know, what is a very broad thing? And it's when people, the layperson interprets the military, they always think infantry, whether they know it or not. You know, I talked to people when I was living in Europe, they just assume everyone in the military is some sort of infantry component, right? That's just kind of how they see it. It's like, okay, all right, well, maybe leverage on that. And then, the Army grunt population is very sizable. And I have a buddy who was in 10th Mountain. I know Leo, obviously being in the Army, he would be a big help with a lot of that. And I spent a lot of time on Army bases myself when I was in the Marines. And it just seemed like all the signs pointed to where, all right, let's go ahead and pick let's go ahead and pick a unit like this to kind of place Joe Watts and some of these other characters in and go from there.
We've talked about it on the podcast before. There's all these not to knock them at all, but it's like there's all these foundations for these special operation communities with the Range Regiment, with Special Forces, with the SEALs and everything. And that's who's kind of the voice of the veterans right now, all these special operation guys. And like me, I was in special operations, and I'm like, that's such a small pocket of the military, as small as like the population is that join the military and then who become infantry and then who become special operations. It's like, where are the stories of like the normal guys, you know? Because that's what I knew. And I thought that was pretty cool that you kind of tipped the hat to like, hey, this is the American soldier, you know? It's not the American sniper, it's this guy. Like, because
I suppose maybe it was a bit of a stab against this sort of high gloss hero worship that we see a lot, as far as like, you know, if a Navy SEAL wants to promote or not promote something that it, you know, even if it has nothing, okay, if it's one thing, if you're talking about, you know, CQB, okay, but if you're talking about, I don't know, politics or something, why the hell wouldn't an Army grunt be just as capable? And or not even a grunt, something, you know what I mean? And there might have been a little bit in there as well. Yeah.
So this question, let's see if we can get through this. Has there almost been a sense of detachment at times from your real world experience in the war versus writing this novel together as different writers from different branches? It is a wordy, kind of difficult question. I guess what it means is like, how difficult was it for you to pull yourself out of the Marines and put yourself into the armies? It's kind of what...
Not hard at all. Yeah, no, that comes with just... time writing fiction. No, it was fairly easy. In fact, it was fun.
Yeah, you had actually even said like I think I can do a infantryman in drag, right? Like the drag of, yeah, right? Like essentially dressing, you know, dressing the part, you know.
I'm still not sure I understand that question. If anybody else does,
I think it had something to do with you dressing drag. Yeah. That was the question.
No, that one was,
and that's definitely the answer.
It was difficult.
You like to wear dresses.
So, this is at least the last question that was prompted to us, and we can always just kind of go around the room after this. Is what is one practical writing tip each of you would give to those who are trying to begin writing?
Well, for me personally, it kind of like helped having a deadline, like, because otherwise I think I'd be like revising it to death. So for me, it was like, you know, Dave's like, well, we'd like, you know, between like 8,000 and 10,000 words at such and such date. And so that, like, for me helped because it's like, man, I really need to like bang this out and like have something on paper, like put something on paper, you know, and then you can go back if you want. But the hard part, but putting something on paper, I think that's the hard part. And then once you have that, though, you can do a lot with it. But I would say just get some shit on paper.
I would say don't try to reinvent the wheel. You're not going to cut corners if you're serious about this. Read constantly. Throw away your TV. Hit up a bookstore the moment you throw away your TV, and never look back. Because I would say that's the biggest one. Read and read and read again.
I think to be a good writer, you first have to be a great observer. You have to observe the things around you. It's not just enough to have, you know, to write a book about the military having been in the military. You have to have really observed the people who were around you. And I think that one very practical thing that you can do to be a better observer is to leave your fucking phone at home. You know, instead of in that moment of looking at your phone in the checkout aisle or the gas station or whatever it is, to occupy your mind for these couple of little, you know, in between moments, so to speak, with that black glass in front of you, is to actually look around and see how people are interacting with one another, to take the little nuances of movement, of conversation, of the way that a certain person walks with their shoulders down because they're feeling beat down by the world, and, you know, to take that little snippet and to start to work it in into a story that you're working in your head. Always be writing in your head, but you have to be observing the little things around you, the little movements, the little sounds, the life. Be a great observer and leave your phone at home.
So no phone, no TV, fellas, ladies. You know,
I'm gonna contradict myself right now as well, because that's what we do. The phone can be a great place to take notes without people getting suspicious. And I've noticed this. I like writing on a notepad with a pen. But when you do that, you know, you're sitting in a bar and you're observing human behavior and interaction. You pull out a notepad and a pen. You start writing down. People get nervous. You know, they're like, what the fuck is this guy doing? But everybody is used to seeing somebody with a phone in their hand. So you can observe what is around you and be taking notes like you're tweeting some, you know, horrific thing about you know, being appalled about, you know, what somebody did that you don't know to somebody else that you don't know and you'll never meet. And they'll just assume that that's what's going on. And you can really write down all of those observations in real time. And it can be a great tool if you use it as such and not something to distract your attention away and your observations away from the real life and the world that's happening around you. Because when you say write what you know, you don't have to have been in special operations to write something exciting. You can write what you know, and that thing that you know is life that is happening around you. And some of the most successful, amazing, entertaining writers to read are people who really captured the little nuances of human nature, and they did that by paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would also say be prepared to face a lot of rejection. That's another one, is, you know, if you are serious about what you're going to do, you're going to eventually scout out different submissions opportunities, and you're going to submit, hopefully for free, even though some places charge. Ideally, they're for free, just a bit of advice. And you're almost certainly going to get rejected. And you're going to get rejected again and get rejected again. And that's not because necessarily you're a terrible writer. It's just because that's how it goes.
It's similar with women, right? I call it the Babe Ruth theory, right? You just swing at everything and you'll hit plenty of home runs, right? You're going to strike out a whole lot, but just swing, swing, swing. You know, submit, 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 submit. And don't worry about the strikeouts. You'll hit more home runs that way if you're swinging than if you're just standing there.
I've heard so many people tell me, like successful guys, that the number one quality you can have if you want to be successful, it's not intelligence, it's not hardworking, it's none of that, it's not genius, it's persistence. You know, and he's like, the guy who shows up day after day after day, that's who is gonna, you know, be standing up there at the end. So that to me is like, you know, just be persistent if whatever you're gonna do. in life. You know, you really have to be persistent and you have to get after it like all the time.
We were talking about it yesterday a little bit about the kind of the ego journey within it too. Is you kind of talked about don't try to reinvent the wheel because we all think we're so clever and we have this unique perspective and voice and story. This rejection is what's going to humble you, and then that persistence is what's going to drive you forward to hopefully towards greatness, to actually putting something out there.
Yeah, and there is a bit of a paradox in writing because you have to believe in what you're doing, but you also have to accept that you don't know everything. And while you are passionate and you have some conviction towards what you write, you also want to leave yourself malleable to criticism, to remaining teachable. And it's difficult. It's difficult because you kind of have your feet in two different worlds at once. Well, do we want to talk about what Lucky Joe's about?
Yeah, I guess we can give a quick little synopsis, you know, summary.
Well, basically, no spoilers, of course, is that three vets of the G-Watt, they all end up at a funeral for Joe Watts. And one of them ends up in his hands is a quite mysterious letter, and he opens it, and that's really where the story begins. And you learn that Joe Watts is a lot more than meets the eye, and that the story within the story is far from over.
Good way to sum it up.
It's a good plug.
Yeah, that's a perfect plug for what we're talking about. Then now that we're talking about it, what do you think separates this from other military fiction right now? Then
I can't even tell you another military fiction book right now.
Yeah, no,
anything that's a success in military writing since like the past 15 years has been either co-authored or ghost-written memoirs. I honestly really can't even say what's a military. Matterhorn fiction?
Matterhorn is fiction.
Okay, well, then I haven't read it, but Mac, if you're listening, from Pipes and Pages, I'm eventually going to.
I'm gonna get on Moby Dick here real quick too, Mac. I promise. If you're listening, I promise I'm gonna read it.
Well, I would say what in general terms it would separate Lucky Joe from most military books at all is that we employed some fictional elements that you see in like books by Margaret Atwood. You know, is that they're okay? Here, military writing in general runs the risk of being sanctimonious. You know, there's all these gold, you know, lightning rods you can't touch, and these golden calves and such and everything. We definitely defy that in this. is that, you know, there's nothing off topic and there's nothing off limits, and maybe that sort of what you might call street cred that we have. With our backgrounds, permits us to write these things that other people would be crucified if they tried.
Well, yeah, we've talked about that multiple times. It's like they put us up on a pedestal where we're somewhat untouchable with our ideas and opinions, and we only attack each other right now.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Lucky Joe will definitely be a matter of controversy to some extent, and it'll be interesting to see what the feedback is.
At least the signed copy that you did your phallic artwork in, that one, if nothing else, will probably get some lucky winner. We bought the out of all the signed copies is going to get some delicious artwork from
about 12 of you. Stand by.
yeah. Just so that everybody knows, these signed copies going out. There's some special artwork in a few of them. So it's like the golden ticket.
Yes.
Send pictures and we'll post them so the world can see.
Yeah.
Awesome, gentlemen. Well. You guys want to, we'll just tag y'all's Instagrams and all that, but y'all want to say it?
Sure, yeah. So you guys probably know me from the podcast. That's what most people know me. So you can check out the podcast on Spotify and iTunes, World News with BK, and check out the Instagram at BK Actual.
David Rose here. I would plug only my latest fantasy work is Amden Bog. You can get available Amazon, paperback, and ebook. And if you enjoy dark fantasy of the more macabre route, then I would appreciate it.
If I'm gonna plug anything, it's probably I gotta plug Chipotle. Thank you for the delicious burritos. I love everything that you do. keep up the good work. I don't know why the guac has to cost 2¼ though, but hey, you know, profit margin's gotta happen somewhere. But that's that. Everything else, it's right here. It's Lucky Joe's, what we've been talking about. That's the.
Yeah, in fact, don't buy Emden Bog. Just buy Lucky Joe.
Just buy Lucky Joe. And Chipotle.
And Chipotle.
While you're listening to BK's podcast.
Yes, please.
Absolutely. All right, gentlemen, I appreciate it.
I think the biggest misperception is that somehow we're damning. There's nothing really can stop us.